Hello and welcome. I'm Luke Broadwater, and I am a State House reporter at the Baltimore Sun.
And I'm Malia Cromer, pollster and political science professor at Goucher College. And this is Roughly Speaking, Government Edition, a Baltimore Sun podcast where each week during legislative session, we take a closer look at the people, policy, and places that shape our state government.
This week, we're going to talk to Senator Jill P. Carter from Baltimore City's 41st District. She is a Democrat, and she is the former director of Baltimore's Office of Civil Rights.
So among other things, we'll get to know Senator Carter and her district a little better and get her views on criminal justice reform in the state. But first, I want to take a look back at the Baltimore Sun reporting this past week.
Yeah, this was another big week in the General Assembly and in state politics. But a lot of it focused, a lot of the attention was around criminal justice issues. And probably no criminal justice issue was bigger this past week than the information that came out about the tragic case of Anton Black, a 19-year-old black man who died after an encounter with law enforcement in the Eastern Shore town of Greensboro. I sat down with my colleague, Talia Richman, who went down to the Eastern Shore to report this case for a front-page story in The Sun on Sunday. And just a warning, this case does contain some graphic content.
I'm tasing him. Taser.
Okay, I'm here with one of our ACE education reporters, Talia Richman. Talia was down at the Eastern Shore in Caroline County this week reporting a very important story for the state of Maryland, and that is about the case of Anton Black. Talia, tell us what this little town is like on the Eastern Shore.
So Greensboro in Caroline County is a very small town. One resident described it as, you know, you sneeze and you miss it. There is a main street with just a couple stores, you know, a coin-operated laundromat, a gun shop that just opened. It's a very small town where everyone knows everyone. They all go to the same high school where their teachers are the same teachers who taught their parents. It's a really tight-knit community. But right now, for the first time, a lot of residents are saying it feels divided, like there's a rift.
And that is because of the death of Anton Black. This was more than 4 months ago. It's really, I mean, the police department there only has three officers, right? I mean, it's a very small town. Tell us why this sort of blew up in the media in the Baltimore area this week.
So on September 15th, Anton Black was walking along with a 12-year-old boy in this town, and a woman called 911 saying she saw a kidnapping in action.
All right, listen, you're not his brother?
No.
No, I am.
Okay, stay. He's right not there. My brother, bro.
Stop. Stay right there.
That's not my brother. No.
All right, do me a favor. Put your hands behind your back.
I like you.
Put your hands back.
I like you.
Put your hands behind your back.
No, I'm still looking for it. Okay.
On and up.
Just hang out with him.
Negative. The black male wearing all black just fled on foot. Apparently he is a schizophrenic.
When police responded, the little boy who Anton Black was with said, you know, this isn't my brother. Like, I don't know this guy, basically, and ran away. I mean, later his family would say that the two did know each other. They were cousins. But Anton, after being stopped by police, eventually ran, headed back for his mother's home in a trailer park kind of on the edge of town. The Greensboro police officer and two other off-duty officers who happened to be in the area, they joined in a chase along with a civilian on a motorcycle. So it was this group of men chasing after Anton Black while the 19-year-old boy ran back to his family's home, and he jumped in a car outside of the home. The Greensboro police officer hit the window with a baton, shattered it, and tased him through the car window, and eventually the officers all brought Anton down in front of his mother's home, where he went into medical distress. And they, you know, performed CPR, and it was ultimately unsuccessful, and he died at the nearby hospital. So this has really, you know, thrust this tiny, tiny town into the center of a national debate on what happens when an unarmed African-American teenager dies in police custody. The men who chased him, they were all white. There's three officers in Greensboro. They're all white. So some people say, like, you know, how can race be denied as a factor in what happened in his death? And others in the town are saying, I mean, these officers were just doing their job, right? Like, why didn't he stop? So there's a lot of debate about what happened. For a while, for 4 months, there was really no answer to that question of what happened. There was no autopsy report from the medical examiner's office in Baltimore. There was no cause of death. The police had not released body camera footage, so what happened to Anton was largely a mystery. But then it started to get some attention. Governor Larry Hogan was asked about it by your host, Luke
yes,
Frogwater.
Right. I asked the governor about it, yes.
And he said he was taking a personal interest. He wanted answers. And, you know, when Governor Larry Hogan takes an interest in this small town, suddenly, after 4 months, the case moves forward, and we get the autopsy report, which ruled his death an accident. The medical examiner said he died of sudden cardiac death. He said that he had an underlying heart condition as well as a mental illness, which were contributing factors in his death. The autopsy, though, did note 43 blunt force trauma wounds. So, yeah, it really picked up steam this week because of the governor's involvement and the autopsy report and the body camera footage release.
Yeah, it was kind of amazing how quickly things started being released. I mean, this family hadn't seen the autopsy. They hadn't seen the toxicology report. They hadn't seen the body camera footage. And all of a sudden now it's all out in the public. And here's a clip from the video that accompanies your story in the Sunday paper of Anton's dad speaking about his death.
This was a good kid, a good son, a good child. He was a champion runner. He high jumped 6'4", so he was a champion in that. He was a starting wide receiver. I don't know why they would run after this young man like they didn't know him. They knew who he was. They knew his type. He used to volunteer for public events. He did everything. He went to college, studied acting, landed a part in a movie because he used to go to casting calls. He'd go by himself. New York, Richmond, Virginia, Norfolk, anywhere that he was invited. He didn't get a chance to play in the movie because they killed him.
And they did it in front of me.
What was he doing? He didn't have a gun. He didn't shoot nobody. He didn't have a knife. He didn't cut nobody. Can't say that. He didn't have a stick or a brick. Why is he dead? They had the gun. They had the mace. They had the taser. All he got is his little legs to try to get away. And he didn't run from them until somebody started running after him. And then he ran home.
And so where do we go from here, Talia? What's going to happen next?
So the family is not satisfied with the answers that have been provided to them. They see this as just more lies. They feel like the police are covering something up, which the police department, of course, denies. So they are pressing for a civil rights investigation into the case. They want outside eyes looking at the case, and we'll see. They have some really strong legal representation, and I don't think that this is the end of the story here.
And then before I let you go, I wanted to ask you about one other topic that actually is more on your beat. Talia is our great Baltimore City Schools reporter. And just this week, the school board voted, after hearing from some students, to not back a proposal to allow school police officers to carry guns inside the school buildings. What's the latest with that, Talia?
Yeah, so for the last 3 years, pretty much, there's been an issue hanging over the school system, whether Baltimore school police officers should be allowed to carry their guns in the buildings during school hours. And legislation was pre-filed before the General Assembly session saying that they should be, that they should be allowed to carry weapons like other trained and sworn police officers and like other resource officers in other suburban school districts. But the school board voted unanimously against that proposal, effectively killing the bill, because you can't really move forward with something like this without the local support of the school board. And this came after students in the Baltimore Algebra Project basically shut down a school board meeting, saying that they don't want this, they don't want guns in their schools, that they see this as, you know, boosting the school-to-prison pipeline, criminalizing them, and it would overall make them feel unsafe in the buildings, which, of course, is what the opposite of what the other side says, which is that guns in schools would make kids safer in the event that something tragic were to happen.
And who's really pushing for this change for the school police? It's the union, right?
Yeah, the school police union is definitely the loudest voice. But there is also a loud group of parents. I mean, at a lot of the forums I've been to, it's been split 50-50 between people who want school police officers to be armed and ones that want to keep guns out of schools altogether. But yeah, the school police union was definitely the most vocal proponent of this change. They say that not having guns in schools is putting kids and officers at risk, and they don't understand, if they have the same training, why they can't carry guns. I think it kind of boils down to something that one parent advocate said. The school police union goes back to, well, we don't want another Parkland to happen in Baltimore. We don't want another Sandy Hook to happen in Baltimore. And this mother who's on the other side of the debate says, yeah, but we don't want another Mike Brown to happen in Baltimore, or Freddie Gray, or Tamir Rice. So that's how they're seeing the debate. I think that kind of distills where people are at.
Talia Richmond, The Sun's education reporter. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
So it's pretty clear that criminal justice reform issues will dominate this legislative session.
Indeed. And another thing that came up was talk, and we've been talking about this for actually a few weeks on the podcast, including the first episode, but this idea that Johns Hopkins University needs a private police force to patrol not only its campus, but its surrounding areas. And my colleague, Pamela Wood, from the State House Bureau, was there for a press conference with the billionaire Michael Bloomberg, who had some who came to Annapolis and had some comments about this issue.
Unfortunately, the crime rate in Baltimore is still very high, although I supported this mayor, who I think is trying very hard to reduce the murder rate, reduce the crime rate, and she needs help. But in terms of Hopkins, one of the things I do hear all the time from people who trying to decide where their kids are going to go to college, they are worried very much about the crime rate. And when they want to go to a hospital, they worry about the crime rate.
Okay, I am joined now by my colleague in the State House, Pamela Wood, and we're going to keep talking about some criminal justice issues. Pamela, Michael Bloomberg.
Yeah, so Michael Bloomberg, the billionaire, with a B, ex-mayor of New York, came into town. He was scheduled to deliver a lecture at the Naval Academy called the Forrestal Lecture. It's a really prestigious leadership lecture at the Academy. And while he was there, he set up some meetings with state lawmakers, all Democrats, and the stated intent was to talk about gun control. He's a big advocate for gun control, gun safety legislation. But while he was there, he spent a little time talking to reporters, and I asked him about his support for a privatized armed police force at Johns Hopkins University. Of course, Bloomberg is a huge supporter, benefactor of the Hopkins various institutions. He's an alum, and he is entirely in support of this police force, which has been rather controversial.
And anything we can do to help them, help the city reduce the crime rate, particularly if it's something that has been done in every other university and the other hospitals. It's kind of irrational not to have it at the hospital and the university that represents the biggest group of employees in the state and in the city of Baltimore.
And what was the reaction to those comments? I know I talked with Senator Mary Washington, who's been opposed to this privatized police. She thinks there should be some sort of deal with the city police where there can be increased public enforcement. But she doesn't like the idea of a private organization running the police. What did people have to say?
Right. There's one school of thought that is, you know, Senator Washington's school of thought, which is how do you hold accountable a private institution like that? You know, Baltimore City Police, the state university police departments, they have an oversight mechanism. And there's a lot of people who are concerned about that. There's also, I got a lot of feedback to this story, emails, tweets, Facebook. A lot of people have thoughts. Another one is why should Hopkins buy themselves more security and more policing than the rest of the city has? Kind of a haves and have-nots argument that really rankles people. And then there are other folks who think this is a great idea, who say, I'm scared to go to Hopkins to get treatment, or I wouldn't want to send my kid to Johns Hopkins University. And hey, if they can do it and make it safer, it's better for everybody. Really, the opinions I've heard are just completely across the board on this.
And then we have another policing proposal that came out just last week from Delegate Talmadge Branch, and that is to make the Baltimore Police Department fully a city agency. This has been tried a few times in the past but didn't work. Where are we with this debate?
Yeah, it's this odd kind of a quirk, I guess, in state law that whereas county police departments, Annapolis City police departments are local agencies, the Baltimore Police Department is technically a state police agency. So every time the city wants to make a change, say they wanted to require all officers to live in city limits or something like that, they have to go down to Annapolis and get state legislation. The city council, the mayor and council can't make changes like that. So Delegate Branch came into our office and handed us a copy of his bill that would do just that. It's actually a very simple bill. It just changes like one sentence in state law. It has failed before, but I think there's some more support this time. You spoke with Mayor Pugh's office. She's right in support of it this time.
Well, she gave tepid support, initial support. And in the past, it's really been the mayor and the city solicitor who were against it because they felt like it would – I think they felt like the city council would start meddling in the police department. But this time she said it sounds like a pretty good idea, and as long as there's no fiscal impact, why shouldn't the city police department be a full city agency, not a state agency anymore? And then I wanted to talk about one non-policing topic with you. There was a good deal of angst over the last week about the shutdown and its
right
impact on Maryland workers. And you attended a press conference with all the county executives and the mayor talking about it, and also Governor Hogan had an announcement about public transportation.
Right. Yeah, we'll start with the local leaders. It was a lot of them, not quite all of them, but Mayor Pugh, the county executives from Howard, Anne Arundel, Harford, and Baltimore counties all came down to Annapolis. It was on a Wednesday, and actually the Maryland Association of Counties has meetings on Wednesdays, so I think that's when we do see them often in Annapolis. But they came together to decry the effects of the shutdown, to talk about their jurisdictions, what they were doing to cope with this. We have a lot of federal workers, federal contractors in Maryland, and they were calling on both Congress and the president to end the shutdown, which did temporarily a couple days later. We also heard from Governor Hogan last week. He, too, has decried the shutdown. He's used a little more colorful language, calling, I believe, Congress a bunch of two-year-olds. But he had a real policy proposal, which is free bus rides and train rides on MTA for federal workers affected by the shutdown.
We have 150,000 Marylanders and their families that are impacted. These are real people. These are people who aren't getting a paycheck. A new program we're launching today where we're going to waive all fees for these impacted federal employees for all MTA services. Every single state transportation service is going to be free for these state employees so they can get to work without having to come out of their pocket.
And there's also a campaign to collect donations at state offices, actually in the State House basement right outside our office. There's a collection spot where people can bring in gift cards or non-perishable foods.
Yeah, I think the number was from the comptroller's office that it's over 140,000 Marylanders were affected by the shutdown, either as furloughed or contractors who won't get paid at all.
Yeah, and then what happens is those folks, I believe they missed two paychecks before we are back, at least temporarily. So there, it's hundreds of millions of dollars in lost wages that maybe they'll get back, but also tens of millions of dollars of local income tax not coming to Maryland and to the city and the counties. So if this had kept going, some of these jurisdictions might have actually been in a cash crunch, not having that money coming in. But now that the feds hopefully will be repaid, their withholdings will be remitted, and things will get back on track.
And we'll just see if we have to do it again in 3 weeks. So.
3 weeks.
Pamela, thanks so much.
Thanks, Luke.
Okay, I want to talk about one more thing before we bring on our guests. This is something that I'm absolutely thrilled about. It was reported this last week that the Maryland House of Delegates will live stream sessions in 2020, and the Senate will follow suit in 2021. On the House side, this move came a day after a bipartisan team of delegates, Republican Kathy Schlega, friend of the show, and Democrat David Moon, introduced a bill that would require the streaming. Speaker Bush's chief of staff, Alexandra Hughes, told reporters that they would partner with Maryland Public Television to stream the sessions, and there would be captions identifying who is speaking. So I believe that this move is not only the right thing to do, not just for transparency's sake, but because we should be providing as many opportunities as possible for citizens to learn about and pay attention to their state government. And I'll say this is the sort of the big reason why. There was a recent study by two Johns Hopkins professors, Jennifer Bochner and Benjamin Ginsberg, and they found some really ugly findings about the amount of sort of political knowledge people have about their state government. You can take a look at their full results linked on our show notes. But the big things are that fewer than 20% of Americans nationwide could name their state legislators, and almost half of those surveys couldn't say whether their state spent what their state spent the most on, or and even fewer knew what state issues were the most controversial. So this sort of low level of political knowledge, we need to try to correct it because state government makes such a big difference in people's everyday lives. And so I'm glad to see the state making this kind of big step forward. But on the reporting end of it, Luke, does it make a difference for you?
It's helpful. It will be. I assume it will be helpful once I see the end product. Right now, we do have audio streaming, which is useful. I mean, I basically know who's talking, so it doesn't. But I would think to the average citizen, they would have no idea who these voices were in a way that they would if they could see their faces and had some help from a TV camera. It's good to note, I think, that the Senate said they will follow a year after the House, and then we'll all get to hear lovely things like Senator Miller singing Annie, which he did on Monday. I love to play Miller clips, and so I'm going to play him singing Annie right now.
No.
Thank you, Mr.
Tomorrow,
President.
Tomorrow.
Senate Bill 27.
No way.
The senator from District 43 has clearly started a trend here. We're all going to sing on the floor. Senate Bill 27.
All right, well, that brings us to our guest today, Senator Jill Carter, a Democrat representing Maryland's 41st District. Welcome to Roughly Speaking, Senator.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Okay, so first I'm going to give our listeners a quick overview of your electoral history as well as some important factors about your district. So you represent one of the districts in Maryland where the primary is basically the general. And so I'm going to give some facts about your primary election and your electoral history. So you have been a winner, to say the least. Every time you've run, you've been the top vote getter, and you won outright in one of the most publicized and most focused on elections this last cycle when you ran and won your seat for Senate. So tell us a little bit about your district.
First of all, let me just say, I was born in the 41st District in the most wonderful neighborhood called Ashburton, which is one of the most unique black middle class neighborhoods, or was historically, and we hope to keep it that way, in the country. Not just the state, not just the city, but the country. And then it's Ashburton, Howard Park, Gwen Oak, Mount Washington, and Roland Park, Cheswold, at the tip of Roland Park, an area called Winehurst, and then Cheswold, which is a very Jewish neighborhood. And it's Orthodox Jewish, many of them. And in fact, one time I heard that it was the highest concentration of Jewish people on the East Coast in that corridor. And so, it's a very diverse district, racially and economically. And it's a wonderful district. I think it's a great opportunity. I've always had a desire to bring communities together, and I feel that I have a better chance at it now that I'm a senator, as opposed to just a delegate with a senator and two other delegates that may not have shared the same vision.
Wonderful. Okay, so I've heard a lot of people refer to you as the people's champion. And so thinking about that moniker, that has to make you feel good as an elected official to have to carry that.
It does feel good.
Yeah.
It makes me feel like some people were actually paying attention to some of the things I tried to accomplish.
So how do you think you earned it?
So it's funny because I think that by championing causes for people that were otherwise ignored in the General Assembly. And so, I mean, there's actually so many things that people don't know about. But going all the way back to, like, my freshman time, there was so Thornton was implemented before I came. It was passed before I came. But after Thornton was passed and I was a freshman in General Assembly, Judge Kaplan ruled that even under Thornton, Baltimore City schools were still being underfunded between $400 and $800 million. So I remember I got some students from the Algebra Project together, and I filed a motion to reopen the Bradford case to push for that money. And I also put in legislation to try to push for it. And that wasn't successful. But out of naivete, thinking, well, this is the right thing to do, and it's also my obligation to push for this, I did it. So I think little things like that, like, you know, it wasn't my intention to kind of challenge or the establishment, but I often found myself in situations where I was doing that, which I think is sad, because I think the establishment should have been pushing for constitutional funding for Baltimore City Schools.
Okay, so thinking back to this idea of being the people's champion, so what residents in your community have consistently sort of shown up for you and helped you win, been so successful electorally? So who's your kitchen cabinet? Who are the folks that really, your community members that really, that help you out?
So I don't really have a kitchen cabinet, you know.
Okay.
I was always a bit of a loner for many years. Now, there's wonderful, wonderful people that stepped up to help me in this campaign, and I was very thankful for it from all different districts. And what I found, the common theme that people liked is that they felt that I spoke up. It wasn't necessarily what I spoke up about or anything. It was just that they didn't think that I was, you know, a shrinking violet or that I was a go-along, get-along, and that caused the support that I got.
Okay, and so you mentioned, I think that you've been a champion for issues that now I think are really in vogue, but back in 2002, really, nobody was really talking about it. So I went back and I looked through all your sponsorship records, and it really, what really struck me was how expungement of records was something you've been fighting for since around 2002 that has now become something that is almost all progressives have to fight for if they want to kind of carry the label as progressive. Can you talk a little bit about your your legislative history, things that you're most proud of, and any sort of legislation that really helped your district?
Sure. So it's interesting. So we still have a lot of work to do with expungement. Like, we're still not doing the right things in terms of allowing expungement for serious crimes and felonies enough. We need to go further with that. But we also have loopholes that we need to close because there's still non-convictions that are not able to be expunged, and I'm pushing for that again now. But I was pushing for it since 2003. So those are important things. But I think beyond expungement, I think we have to stop putting the onus on the person that is at issue and put the onus on the employers and the housing agents and the realtors, because we need to stop forcing people to overcome these obstacles on their own. We need to get buy-in from other entities that understand that people that have served their time and paid their debt to society need to live somewhere. They need to have real opportunities.
So something that folks from outside of Baltimore might not know about you, Senator Carter, is that you've come from a long line of civil rights leaders. Can you talk a little about your family and perhaps their influence on your worldview?
It's interesting because when you're growing up, you don't really realize how much your family affects you. But over the years and the issues I've championed and some of the issues that I've taken on were tough and alone and I thought were fair, really do stem from, I think, the DNA of my dad. Some years ago, there was a documentary about him, Walter P. Carter, Champion for Change. He was a real trailblazer, and many people that were around for the civil rights struggle have said that it somewhat died when he died in 1971. He was a leader in fighting the blockbusting, the redlining of then Morris Goldsecker. and other speculators along Edmonton Village Corridor and other places in the city. He, not single-handedly, but with the work of CORE, because he was the chair of CORE at some point, walked the line between here and the Eastern Shore, desegregating segregated establishments. He also fought the very resistant Gwin Oak Park that was privately owned, and even when desegregation laws passed, because they were private, they were allowed to still discriminate. So those kinds of things.
So we've been talking a lot about criminal justice issues. And this session, I feel like there's going to be this perennial tension between those who want tough on crime policies and those who want smart on crime policies. What do you see coming forward this session?
It's going to be very interesting, certainly, because you've got sort of agreement between the governor and legislative leadership about the need for, in their both of their beliefs, need more police in Baltimore City and funding for more police officers, and then also agreement about private policing being expanded in Baltimore City. I actually disagree with all of those things. I think that the real solution is to stop doing things the wrong way that we've done so long and change our policies. And so I will, I have put in a bill that would require funding for community-based organizations that are that have as their mission crime prevention. And so I think that prevention is the key, not criminalizing people, but preventing them from criminalization. And so that's what I'm going to push for.
What do you see some of those things being that will prevent crime?
Intervention, well, come on, the list is so long. Mm-hmm. First of all, something that the legislature is completely at fault for never doing is ending lead poisoning, because lead poisoning is often a precursor to juvenile delinquency and then criminality and complete dysfunctionality as adults. We have never honestly addressed that issue in the legislature. Ending lead poisoning, adequately funding the schools. I'm glad to hear that there's now an effort to want to start with pre-K and expand pre-K everywhere. I think that's a good start. But then it's important that we don't lose students in the middle, which is where all the trouble starts, and we have to work on that. I think opportunity. I mean, the whole reason that I'm not a criminal and that you're probably not a criminal, Luke, is because we thought we had something to lose if we did something wrong. But if you have no belief that you have anything to lose, like, you know, stealing this from a store or robbing someone is not going to prevent you from becoming a reporter or a Supreme Court justice, which is what I used to want to be, then you don't. There's no incentive not to do it. And so I think that we have to motivate and influence young people to believe that there's real opportunities and really make that possible, like really make it possible that there are opportunities for young people, primarily black, that live in Baltimore City.
And then a couple of years ago, I wrote about your effort to hold the lead paint companies accountable for years and years of marketing lead paint to the public and even specifically to children sometimes, and then the very horrible effects it's had here in Baltimore. And that bill kind of went nowhere. I understand it might be coming back this year. Delegate Mosby said he's interested in sponsoring it. Where do you think that effort stands?
I don't really know. I mean, there's never been support from the legislative leadership for it. There's always been just victims, and then the trial lawyers have been in support of it primarily. But it boggles the mind that the science has shown and the research has shown that lead poisoning destroys brains. It's shown that these companies were well aware of the effects of it and still continue to distribute it and sell it in Baltimore City. So the only place to go for the money and the resources we need to abate it is the companies. And so it's also very interesting that the Property Owners Association, which pretty much resists all efforts to abate lead and all efforts to be held accountable, has never been in support of the bill. And I've always thought they should line up with the victims and line up with the tenants and support this effort, but they have not done so. I think there's always still got to be a way to try to get them involved.
And then I wanted to ask you about your tenure as the director of the Office of Civil Rights. You left the State House, the House of Delegates, to join the Pew administration as the director, did a lot of work with the Civilian Review Board and other aspects of city government. But then you departed upon running for state senate. Can you tell me your perspective on how everything unfolded?
Yeah, it's kind of weird. The lesson and the message is never say never, because you never know what the future holds. If someone had suggested to me that I would be back in the legislature, I would have told them they were crazy. I left the legislature very intentionally and very frustrated and somewhat angry and defeated, because I was very unhappy that I felt I had spent such a large portion of my adult life there and very little had been accomplished. So I very happily left. I thought that the opportunity that Mayor Pugh offered me was a dream job of a lifetime to do civil rights work, which is my passion, which was I was often condemned for in the legislature. And so I took it on full force. The office, the agency, was actually kind of a disaster when I got there. For the first time under my leadership, we had a fully staffed civilian review board and all of the other boards that were under the office. And so we worked really hard to try to get the office in shape to realize its intended purpose. I feel like we were on the cusp of that when I was forced to step down. And so the reason I was forced to step down was that Solicitor Andre Davis, although he issued no written opinion that I've seen or that the public has seen, he opined that I could not accept the appointment as senator and continue to have the job. I disagree with that. I wrote a memo about that. The board members wrote letters asking for my reinstatement, but it never happened. And so that's that. You know, I think he was wrong, and I think there was probably some other motivation for it. Like, he didn't like what I was doing with the Civilian Review Board, or he didn't like that he couldn't control me and the board, because if you recall, the second that while I was there, the board wound up suing because of Andre Davis's order that the police didn't have to give the CRB files, Civilian Review Board. And then the second that I left, the board, they dropped the lawsuit, and, you know, there's a kumbaya moment, even though it's my understanding that they still don't have all the files. And I feel like it's a bad situation now, because I understand that Andre Davis, the solicitor, actually controls the office. And actually, the new director is, I'm told, an employee of Andre Davis. Like, he hired him, and he oversees him. So I think that the Civilian Review Board and the office itself need to have more independence. And I'm going to push for that legislatively, for the CRB. I'm going to push for legislation to transform the CRB into an independent, effective civilian oversight agency.
And then what's next for you? You ran for mayor before. your name is often...
I want people to forget this.
did you see yourself staying in the Senate for a while, or what do you think?
We have to see. I mean, if it goes well, if it goes anything like the House of Delegates, we can rest assured that it will be one term. But if it goes better, which it already seems like it's starting out better, I would consider staying as long as I think I can be effective. I really have never had political aspirations. The only thing I ever wanted to be was mayor. Why? Because mayor controls the policies and the purse strings. That is the only real power position to change Baltimore and right the wrongs that have existed for far too long in this city.
Great. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, that's all the time we have this week on Roughly Speaking, Government Edition. Thank you, and I hope this episode is reported on favorably.
You've got those puns coming every week, don't you?
Yes.
Well, thanks for joining us, and I want to say a big thank you to our producers, Steve Early and Hallie Miller. They've just done a great job through these first four episodes. And if you like what you heard, please find us and subscribe to the Apple Podcasts or wherever you find your podcasts. While times change, the need for quality journalism doesn't. So please consider a subscription to the Baltimore Sun at www.baltimoresun.com. Thanks, and see you next week.